Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, November 2nd, 2018. A new report says journalists in Sudan are not free to do their job.
Well, the government, they feel that their narrative or their story could be abused or jeopardized by the stories that are told by journalists, like the one that we interviewed.
And Riek Machar's spokesman is a free man once again.
I think this is the same day I was arrested in Nairobi on the 2nd of November 2016. And today is 2nd of November 2018, exactly 2 years. I want to thank His Excellency the President, General Salva Kiir Mayardit, for ordering my release.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Amnesty International has issued a new report on the conditions of journalists in Sudan. The rights group says interrogations, arbitrary arrest, and intimidation are tactics the Sudan government uses to crack down on media workers. These allegations come at a time when newspapers have been confiscated and journalists harassed. Some have even been jailed, as we hear from Ayen Deng Bior in Washington.
The job of a journalist is to ask questions, to hold people in power accountable, and to disseminate accurate and objective information without fear or favor. That job is intentionally made harder in Sudan, according to Ahmed El-Zobir, Amnesty International's Sudan researcher, who says state actors have repeatedly harassed and intimidated journalists.
Don't talk about the national security. Don't talk about the police. Don't talk about the Sudan Armed Forces, don't talk about the president, don't talk about, don't interview armed groups, you know, those armed groups from Darfur or from South Kurdistan, you know, that kind of issues. And now the issues around corruption, this is a very topical issue in the country, they don't want to talk about that as well.
Amnesty has documented the arrest and detention of at least 15 Sudanese journalists this year by the country's National Security Service. It says editions of Al Jarida, an independent newspaper in Sudan, has been confiscated at least 13 times this year. El-Zobir says 10 newspapers have been confiscated 27 times, and there is no indication that repression will slow down anytime soon, as Sudan's public looks for answers to critical questions about the country's economy, reports of widespread corruption, and other matters of the state.
Well, the government, they feel that their narrative or their story could be abused or jeopardized by the stories that are told by journalists, like the one that we interviewed during this publication. So that's why they want it. They want their narrative, their story, to be the dominant one, and any other story they just claim to be untrue or fabricated, or, as you might say now,
Sudanese officials could not be reached for comment on this story. But Sudan Foreign Minister Al-Dirdiri Mohamed Ahmed had this to say about the press in his country during an interview with VOA in late September.
When you speak about a free press, of course, that's a concept that is very much could be approached differently from different circles of the world and very much nuanced. Free press, for instance, in Scandinavia is not like free press in North America. Nor does it look like free press in the Far East. But according to the standards that are applicable in our part of the world, we really have a free press.
In June, the Committee to Protect Journalists called out Sudanese authorities for harassing and censoring the press. It said the country's national intelligence and state security were accused of stopping the distribution of local Al-Tayar and Al-Yum Al-Tali dailies. Freedom House ranks Sudan as one of the least free countries in the world with respect to press freedoms. Out of 199 countries, Sudan is 183 in its 2017 index, with the number one country being most free and 199 the least free. El-Zobir says Sudanese journalists often censor themselves to protect their safety.
Unfortunately, they don't feel comfortable working in such an environment. They feel they are silenced in many cases. They want to talk about many issues around the country, but they cannot really report on it because of all these red lines applying by the national security, which can change sometimes.
Amnesty International is calling on the Sudanese government to revise its Press and Printed Materials Act of 2009 so that it states clearly that press freedoms are protected in the country. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan prison officials freed Riek Machar's spokesman, James Gadet, and former SPLM-IO security advisor Colonel William John Enley. Both men were sentenced to death by hanging. Wake Simon Wood reports for VOA from Juba.
Both James Gadet and Colonel William John Enley, a South African citizen, were found guilty of treason and espionage. After being released this afternoon, both men were all smiles before the cameras. Unlike other prisoners of war released last week at Juba's National Security Headquarters, who appeared haggard with rough-looking skin, Gadet and Enley appeared to be in good condition. Michael Chenjek is South Sudan's interior minister.
We are here to implement the orders of His Excellency the President to release these two guys, namely William and James Gadet. Their release comes as part of the peace implementation, and as you have seen them now with us, they are now free.
The September 12 peace agreement requires the parties to release all political detainees and prisoners of war. Addressing a large crowd at the John Garang Mausoleum on Wednesday, Kiir said his administration still needed to check with its security agencies if there were more detainees to be released. Chenjek says he expects Gadet to travel to Khartoum. Enley was driven by security officials from the Juba prison to Juba International Airport. Gadet was arrested by Kenyan security officials and deported from the capital, Nairobi, to South Sudan in November 2016. According to the High Court in Juba, Enley was a political advisor to Machar when he was arrested in Juba in August 2016. His arrest came just days after renewed fighting broke out between government forces and Machar's bodyguards. Both men were sentenced to 20 years imprisonment and were later sentenced to death by hanging. Gadet says he is happy to be a free man after spending 2 years in prison.
I think this is the same day I was arrested in Nairobi on the 2nd of November 2016. And today is 2nd of November 2018, exactly 2 years. I want to thank His Excellency the President, General Salva Kiir Mayardit, for ordering my release. I'm very happy that this will enable me to reunite with my family members and my friends.
Enley says he is thankful that President Kiir pardoned him.
Firstly, the hospitality and the goodness of the common South Sudanese. Unfortunately, in all walks of life, in all countries, you get the good people and you get the bad people. But my memories of South Sudan always will be and have been positive.
Speaking in Arabic, James Gadluak praised the president for releasing his relative.
I am very, very happy.
Saif Magonga, Deputy Director for Amnesty International East Africa, the Horn and the Great Lakes, welcomes the release of the two men, but says more must be done.
It's a relief that two lives have been spared. They were at risk of the death penalty, and that will not happen as a result of, because of this of the pardon that they were given. But that's not really the end of it. There needs to be a proper end to the use of the death penalty. All people who are on death row need to be, their sentences need to be commuted so that no one in South Sudan is executed by the state.
Magango says Enli and Gadete may have been spared, but there are many more people still on death row in South Sudan, and he calls that unacceptable. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The U.S. Embassy in South Sudan is urging signatories to the September 12 peace deal to ensure effective security arrangements for the country. The U.S. says honoring the agreement will win the trust of donors and build confidence among South Sudanese. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
In a statement issued yesterday, the U.S. Embassy says honoring the agreement and providing security in and around Juba is extremely important. Jonathan Sebra, U.S. Public Affairs Officer at the American Embassy in Juba, says effective security arrangement would allow all parties to return safely to the capital and take part in South Sudan's new government.
We urge the parties and regional leaders to carefully consider and work to finalize effective security arrangements for Juba in order to allow all parties to safely return to Juba and participate in governance.
Sebra says while the U.S. Embassy is glad that some political detainees have been released, others are still in government detention units, and emphasized that all parties must commit to the cessation of hostilities arrangements signed in December 2017.
Key steps needed immediately include an end to all fighting everywhere, the release of all political detainees and prisoners of war, including those held by the National Security Service, NSS, and the removal of all impediments to full and unfettered humanitarian access.
The United States, Britain, and Norway, known as the Troika, had in the past said it would only support the cause of implementing the revitalized peace deal if the parties demonstrated their full commitment to adhering to the accord. On Wednesday, President Salva Kiir called on the Troika to support the peace process. He noted that Troika had refused to be one of the signatories and grantors for the revitalized peace agreement, which returns Riek Machar to his previous position as first vice president, while Salva Kiir remains president. Sebra says all parties must first honor the agreement.
Honoring these commitments is crucial to building confidence and demonstrating political will to the other parties, the South Sudanese people, and international donors.
Sebra also called for a free press, saying it is a fundamental component of a functioning democracy. He called assaults on journalists unacceptable. In his speech on Wednesday, Kiir apologized to the people of South Sudan for the physical and psychological wounds the political leaders caused in their struggle for power and promised to end the people's suffering. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, lawyers protest recent despairing remarks by the mayor of Bor. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which African country do you admire most?
I admire Nigerians. They are very bold and they are go-getters.
I admire DRC Congo because of their music. They perform the best of music ever in Africa. Even though you don't understand what their language, but you admire their music.
I admire Ghana. It's my country, it's my motherland. Moreover, the culture of Ghanaians are unique. We are also very, very hospitable.
I love my country, South Sudan, and I'm so proud of it, despite of the ongoing ups and downs.
I admire Botswana, because Botswana is a good country, it's a cool country. You know, they don't have this other corrupt, other things that are happening in other countries. They're like just like Switzerland in Europe, yeah.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Lawyers in the Jonglei state capital, Bor, are protesting against what they are calling abuse by the Bor municipality mayor. The lawyers say the mayor called Bor lawyers incompetent and crooks and threatened to shut down some of their offices. Dengai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor town.
The president of Jonglei State Bar Association, Mayan Makir, says after Bor Mayor James Guy made the disparaging about Bor lawyers at last weekend church service at St. Andrew Cathedral Church, He asked Jonglei State Governor Philip Aguirre to order the mayor to apologize.
What was released by the mayor was really contrary with the provision of Article 136 of the Transitional Constitution 2011, amended 2015. This is the purpose of the intervention letter to His Excellency Governor of Jonglei State. He accepted to call the mayor and advise him to choose one of two. Either apologize before the congregation in the cathedral church where he released a statement on 21st October 2018 and apologize to the institution of Bar Association of Jonglei State. He should have to apologize on that. Or if he failed to apologize, we will initiate a criminal case against him.
Makir says the lawyers have asked the governor to leave the mayor's immunity if he fails to apologize.
To practice as a legal advocate or practicing advocate in South Sudan, we have bar counsel. After you proceed as a trainee lawyer for the period of 1 year, then you present the original certificate before the bar counsel. And the members of the Bar Council is comprising from the Supreme Court to the Minister of Justice, the legal professional with the much qualifications and experience in the law practice. That was the only body verified the document of the lawyers.
Lawyer Mamer Dengale says his reputation and those of his colleagues were smeared by mayor's speech. Alair says immunity cannot be allowed. He adds that all government officials should be held accountable for their words and action.
As an advocate, we respect the government, but we don't need the government to just do things and go with impunity. No, we know our rights. Then the Honorable Mayor has crossed his bridge, and Mayor give us apology and fine. If there is no apology in that, then automatically we will file the criminal case against him.
Mamer says advocates are mandated by South Sudan National Transitional Constitution to prevent injustice and defend the legal rights and interests of their clients. He says lawyers should be respected for the work they do. Bor Municipal Mayor James Guy Makur admits he talked about the work of Bor lawyers during his speech last weekend.
To apologize, did not reach me. And then the message that I say we have document from individual advocate that sent to Juba. And it is the government who planned this plan of Bor Town, mother plan of Bor Town. If need to be alterated, it is good also they came to us. Then encourage the public that they have to go to Juba, they have to go to the court. Yeah. Like even in the opening of road from Nabasha, one of the lawyers went to the strike with community.
Mayor Guy says he will decide whether to issue an apology to Bor lawyers once he receives an official request from the governor. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng reporting from Bor Town.
Indigenous people around the world face many challenges, including marginalization, forced removal from their ancestral lands, and threats to their culture. These threats underlie the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. To ensure compliance by member states, the UN Human Rights Council appoints a special rapporteur to speak to indigenous groups, to advocate for their interests, and to make regular reports to the General Assembly. VOA's Adam Phillips recently spoke with the current special rapporteur, Victoria Tutulis, who herself is an indigenous person.
In the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples, it has Article 3, which recognizes the right of indigenous peoples to self-determination, which means they have the right to determine their political status and the right to freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. And Article 4 talks about autonomy and self-governance at the community levels. And of course, this also includes how to shape the education system, the health system, and that is part of ensuring political participation of indigenous peoples. It's not just to join join political parties or to run in elections, but also to recognize their capacities to elect their own officials and govern themselves. You know, these governance systems existed long before colonization and even after nation states were created, and they continue to exist now in many countries despite all the efforts to undermine and put this under the modern systems.
I understand that conservationists, who are usually, you know, cast as the good guys in these dramas, are also posing some problems for indigenous peoples.
In Africa, definitely the creation of national parks, which have been pushed by these conservation organizations, has displaced indigenous peoples from their territories. That's the other side of conservation. I mean, indigenous peoples have been doing conservation. That's precisely why a lot of the areas that are better kept overlap with their territories. But the human rights approach to conservation is not observed, which means that the conservationists think that you kick out all the people and you will conserve the forest. But that's not true. You know, many of these forests are in that state because the people relate with the forest. They work in the forest. They help increase the biodiversity as well. As we speak, there are parks which are being created but also being taken over by countries who want to promote tourism, wildlife tourism. You know, so we have situations in Tanzania where the Saudi government is wanting to take over national park. So in the report that I made, you can see that I made a very strong recommendations to governments in terms of how they should ensure that the rights of indigenous peoples who live and depend on those forests are not violated.
And of course, agribusiness is another reason why ancestral lands are being threatened. How is the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples relevant here?
The right of indigenous peoples to self-determination allows them to determine the kinds of relationship that they will have with external actors. One of the key problems in Africa is that they are never consulted when this expansion of agribusiness corporations are done. In fact, in Kenya, I know that many grazing lands have been fenced off to plant palm oil or whatever crops that the state wants to have and to bring the agricultural farmers into these territories. And that has really led to a lot of problems for the pastoralists. And, of course, they have these government projects where they are building hydroelectric dams. And it's, of course, funded a lot by Chinese capital as well.
It sounds like indigenous peoples are making a moral claim to these lands.
Definitely, it's a moral claim, you know, but also they have also the legal claims to it. Because, of course, many of these governments have adopted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, like the Maasai, for instance, in Kenya, the hunters and gatherers and the pastoralists. They managed to influence the Kenyan government to acknowledge that there are collective lands and that these lands should be recognized. You know, that's when you see that there are some positive changes that come about. But it varies from country to country. It depends on the legal framework that exists, you know. I see cases being won in the African court, in Kenya, in Congo, Brazzaville, of course in South Africa, in Namibia, in Botswana. They have a legal framework. But generally, it's still in a very, very bad situation.
That was Victoria Tolikopoulos, the United Nations Special Rapporteur for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Germany and the Netherlands plan to fund a special border force in Niger to help prevent illegal immigration. Thousands of West Africans cross Niger each year, hoping to reach Libya or Algeria and then cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. Reporter Catherine Field in Paris has been following this story. She spoke to VOA's Kate Pound Dawson today.
The plan is that the European Union needs to, if you like, consolidate or even expand or make more coherent its enormous policy it already has in place for security and development in the Sahel. Now, Niger is what they consider a priority country. So having now invested in food security and the political process and national development, the EU now needs to look more closely at the borders. Now, it already has some sorts of troops in the northern part of Niger. Now it needs to look at the southern area. And that is why Germany and the Netherlands have come together under the umbrella of the European Union and said they will finance to the tune of 10 million euros border troops and police forces that will patrol Niger's southern border with Nigeria. Now, it is always thought that at least 90% of migrants who come to Europe have come through Niger. Those are the ones who've come from West Africa. So by patrolling that border more efficiently, by training the police there more efficiently and how to deal with illegal migration, with people traffickers, with drug trafficking, then Europe will be able to take one more step in solving what it considers to be the migration crisis.
Now, does this involve sending any European personnel to Niger?
Indeed it will. They will be going to Niger. They will be training the Niger police. They will be helping to equip them. They will be also showing them how they can decide. It's a difficult issue, but how they can help to decide who gets immediately sent back on that border and who will be allowed into these, if you like, these halfway houses, these holding centers, or even these transit centers, some are calling them, that the EU have already set up in Niger. So those are the sort of issues that these police will be helped to deal with. Because let's not forget, the EU does already fund those six transit centers in Niger. So this decision by Germany and the Netherlands to, if you like, fortify the border really works in with that program that is already in place in Niger.
Now, does this interact with the G5 force in the Sahel? France is very active in that force. Does it interact at all with that?
Not as yet. More they're seeing it as interacting with the International Organization for Migration, which is already in Niger, and it's got these resettlement and reintegration projects going, not just in Niger, but also in Senegal, Guinea-Bissau, Mali, Guinea-Conakry, and in Cameroon. So they're seeing it more as going along in that way, is that you're looking more at community-based projects and business training projects. This is where that has to fit in, as opposed to the more military-based, your G5 Sahel bases that they have in that area.
That was journalist Catherine Phil in Paris speaking with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson. That is our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Emoya by Dis Majos. We have been listening to Dis Majos with the song Emoya. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a safe weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah, yeah,